Now, The Interpreter Show, with discussion, debate, and the latest information on all kinds of religious issues and topics.
All right, welcome to this week's edition of The Interpreter Show. I am your host for the night, I guess, Neil Rapley. Here in studio with me is the infamous, apparently, infamous Stephen Smoot, along with my lovely wife, Jasmine Rapley, and joining us by phone is Hales Swift. All right. Welcome, everybody, I guess.
Glad to be here.
Thanks for having us.
Okay, so this last week, not super eventful, I suppose, but this upcoming week is actually pretty exciting. Welcome to September, everybody, I suppose. Stephen, do you maybe want to tell everybody about what's happening this week with the church, I guess?
So, I don't want to exaggerate here, but literally what's happening in 2 days is the greatest event in the history of mankind. And what I mean by that is in 2 days, the church will formally publish in its entirety a new book on church history titled Saints, The Story of the Church of Jesus Christ in the Latter Days. This has been in the works for some time now. And I was being just a little bit hyperbolic in my first statement, but in all seriousness, and I don't mean this hyperbolically, this will probably be the most important history of the church that's been published since B.H. Roberts,
right.
Since his comprehensive
Absolutely.
History of the church.
Absolutely.
The amount of effort and the amount of skill that has gone into composing this history is phenomenal. I've had a chance to read an advanced copy of it, as well as have some others, and some reviews are just starting to get posted. My review will be posted on the Interpreter website on Tuesday, on the day the book launches.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm, of course, I'm sure we'll talk about tonight what there is so far that they've published, but it is phenomenal. And I think there's a lot of good stuff in there that we should talk about, that we should make our listeners familiar with, and maybe also talk a little bit about what went into this, what sort of has been amped up about this, and the elements going into it that make it so important.
Yeah, absolutely. And
also might be interesting to discuss this evening the history of the church. Why is the church producing a new history of the church? What have we done in the past to produce a history? And why is it important for the church to produce a history of itself?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, we can definitely get into all of that. For some quick background for our listeners, those of you who may not have heard about Saints before, this is a history of the church, as Stephen mentioned, that is being published by the church. It's a big initiative on the part of the Church History Department, and the Brethren have been really pushing it. You should know this is going to be published with a First Presidency letter in the beginning of the book, or I don't know if you call it a letter, First Presidency message, I guess.
Like a forward.
Like a preface, yeah.
Just like in the hymn book, for instance. And so this is an official history. This is an official church publication. If you haven't been following along, it has been, the first 8 chapters of it have actually already been published serially in the Ensign starting this last February. And then publishing one chapter a month since then, leading up to this month where they published actually chapter 7, and then chapter 8 will come out in October. And then from there, they will not continue to publish chapters in the Ensign. So,
and they have been published in your Gospel Library app as well.
Right, and that's true. And not just because the Ensign's in your Gospel Library app. You can go to the Gospel Library app, go to the Church History section, and you'll see Saints, Volume 1, and it'll show you the first 7 or 8 chapters. And so if this is exciting to you and you don't want to wait till Tuesday to read the whole thing, to start reading it, you can actually get started right now. Go back through your Ensigns, go to your Gospel Library app, and it's on there.
And then as of September 4th, Volume 1 will be out in print. It'll be like a 600-some page volume that will cover from 1815, I believe, to 1844 when 46. Right. After mm-hmm. the prophet Joseph Smith is martyred and they're taking their exodus from Nauvoo. And this whole history of the church is going to cover the entirety of church history, and it will be in four volumes. Volume one is covering the early restoration period, so like I mentioned, from 1815 to 1846. The second volume is going to talk about the settlement in Utah and the church establishing its stakes of Zion there, and it will go up until 1893, with the dedication of the Salt Lake Temple. I believe the third volume is going to be discussing the global church, its global growth in primarily the 20th century, and then kind of culminating and ending with the dedication of the Bern, Switzerland Temple in 1955, since that's kind of a big watershed marker.
The first one outside of the continental United States, or outside
Correct.
Of the United States.
Yeah,
so that in was a huge land.
First one in Europe, first one outside of
international church. Yeah,
and then the fourth volume will be our more recent history from the 1950s up until now, and it will not just be a history of local saints in Utah, in Zion, quote unquote, but a global history of the church, because this church and its history belongs to all of its members.
Yeah, and that's one of the major revolutions of saints. Is it's not just in the words of the editors, it's not just a dry formal marshaling of historical facts, right? Mm-hmm. This is very common where you just go from one date to the next chronologically, and it's just this sort of streamlined, dry recitation of facts about history.
Right.
Rather, I think it's more comparable to maybe a tapestry or a quilt or something like that, where you have individual patches being the lives of individual Latter-day Saint men and women that are being sewn together into a bigger picture. So volume one of Saints has all your standard sort of notable Mormon figures. There's, of course, Joseph Smith and Sidney Rigdon and Emma Smith and Oliver Cowdery and Brigham Young and all these great people. But you'll also meet new people or unheard of Latter-day Saints.
And like, you'll hear stories.
You know, hear stories about them and about
about
how they joined the church, how they found the church, what happened with their experience inside of it, and so forth. So it's this emphasis is to be that it's about the individual members, high and low, and the contributions that they make to church history and how their lives are as much a part of the picture as, you know, Joseph Smith and Brigham Young and the luminaries that we think about when we think of Mormon history.
Right.
I would also add, for the first seven chapters, which I've read, it seems to me that it builds a really good outline of the key events into which you could drop, say, Rough Stone Rolling or any of these other more detailed histories, such as From Darkness Unto Light, and you'll be able to recognize where everything fits in really well. But the saint's history is... seems to stick somewhat to the highlights and the exciting stuff, which is kind of fun,
right,
in terms of making it enjoyable to read.
Yeah, absolutely.
Agreed. I mean, I think that was, as Stephen touched on, and as you just mentioned, that is one of the main focuses of Saints, is to not be a dry documentary history, but to be something that is engaging and interesting and powerful. And they do that by... exploring individual lives, taking little vignettes of these characters in church history, but also telling a very engaging story in the way that they write it. I mean, this does not feel like a textbook of history. And so if people are daunted by the 600-page length, they shouldn't, because it's quite the gripping read. They very deliberately made this to be a literary as well as a historical experience.
Right. And before we go much further, I do want to just say, like we mentioned... this is coming out Tuesday, and just to make you aware of all the different ways you'll be able to access and read this history starting Tuesday. Tuesday, in addition to the seven chapters that are already there, the whole book will be immediately available in your Gospel Library app, online, on the church website. You'll have 100% free access to the whole book. You can just start reading it. It'll also be available in print as a paperback that I believe the church will be selling for $5. So
Dirt cheap.
If you are anything like me and buy a lot of history books, especially 600-page ones that just looks like they're going to have so much amazing good information, you know that $5 is never how cheap those books are. They're usually very expensive. So the church is doing everything they can to make this very easily available. On Tuesday, there will be an event at the Church History Museum. Stephen Harper, who has been the managing editor, who has overseen the writing and editing and publication of at least this volume of Saints, and I believe the other volumes as well. He was also recently appointed editor-in-chief of BYU Studies. He's a very, very good historian. He will be speaking at the Church History Museum at kind of a launch party Tuesday evening, and you'll be able to get copies there if you want to go downtown and check that out and see kind of what all the hype and excitement is about with this new church history.
And if you're more into the whole podcast thing or like audiobook thing, which a lot of people these days are, besides being able to read it for free online, you can actually download individual chapters as essentially audiobooks, read by both a male or a female voice. You can choose which one you want, which one you prefer. And so that's also makes it accessible that way for like the morning commute, for example. And the other thing I think that's worth mentioning here is that when Saints launches in 2 days on September 4th, it will be published in 15 languages.
Right.
So something like 90% of the church, 95% or something, will be able to, on day one, read the entire thing in their native language. And Stephen Harper, when he was speaking at the Fair and Mormon Conference just a few weeks ago, he was talking about Saints and was talking about the process of getting it published. And when they approached the First Presidency about getting funding and resources to have it translated into all these other languages, Steve Harper said that they expected the First Presidency to say, well, okay, we'll start with English and Spanish, and over time we'll roll out Portuguese and French and Italian and German and so forth, right? So they were expecting over time maybe to get all the languages out. He said, we were given full authorization and full funding and resources to get them done on day one in all these other languages. Mm-hmm. Like, that's how serious the First Presidency was about making this available to the church worldwide. So I think that's a testament to how serious the leadership of the church wants the average member of the church to read this, wherever they might be, whatever country they might be or continent. And how vital they want this to for members everywhere to understand that this is part of their story, this is part of their identity.
Absolutely.
It's not just a white, English-speaking Utah thing, right? Like, this is around the world.
And I do want to say, as excited as we, as white, English-speaking Latter-day Saints, who are just nerdy about their history, as excited as we are to have this resource available, it is going to be like a fire hose to some of these other regions of the church in some of these other languages where so few resources have been provided before, and there's been so little information available from the church. There's been some stuff, and from third-party organizations like The Interpreter or like Fair Mormon that Stephen just mentioned, or Book of Mormon Central, which is a group all of us here in studio work for. But, you know, so much of... there's a wealth of resources coming from the church and third-party organizations in English. There's very little in some of these other languages. So the fact that the church is going to make sure 95% of membership has access to this in their native language right from the start, that is an absolutely impressive, and what a blessing that is for saints around the world, really, to be able to have access to this. One thing I wanted to maybe jump into now that we've kind of introduced the concept...
Well,
yes.
There's one thing I was thinking about maybe mentioning, depending on where you're going to take this here.
Oh, let's actually maybe get into that after this commercial break. This is The Interpreter Show. All right, and we are back here on the Interpreter Show. I am your host for the night, Neil Rapley. I'm joined in studio by Stephen Smoot and Jasmine Rapley. And we have joining us by phone, Hale Swift. And we have been talking about so far the new history that the church is publishing called Saints. I forget the subtitle. The History of the Church of Jesus Christ in the Latter Days. And we've just kind of given an overview of what exactly it is to help people understand how significant it is. And again, it's a multi-volume project. It's going to be four volumes. It's intended to be representative and relatively comprehensive. You can't really be comprehensive with a 200 years of history, even in four very thick volumes. But this is the most substantive historical narrative the church has published in close to 100 years. And so we want to just take a quick minute or so to talk a little bit about that context and why this church is being this history is being published now and what's really so significant about that.
Right. So the history of the church goes way back to the very beginning. Joseph Smith, in as early as 1839, decided that he needed to record the history of the church. And he received a revelation on it, though I'm not exactly sure which section in D&C it's on. And he decided we need to, you know, keep track of what's going on. So he, along with his brothers in the church, started taking down what was happening in the church. And they worked on this history until Joseph died in 1844, but then again was taken over by Willard Richards, put a lot of work into it. And in 1856, this initial history was done. But then in 1902, B.H. Roberts came along and decided it was time to go through that material again and rework it and edit it and try to corroborate some of the details that might have been just hearsay, and to also expound upon the things that Joseph had recorded. And so then they came out with the history of the church as it was known then. And that kind of became the standard, even though I don't think it ever had official church status.
Well, the six-volume history of the church was officially published by the church at that time, yes.
And it made its way into various editions of the Doctrine and Covenants in terms of like header notes and footnotes and those sorts of things. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, it was never elevated as scripture per se, but it became like the de facto official history was history of the church.
Right.
And nothing ever really replaced it as being comprehensive. In the 1960s, we had Our Heritage come out, which was used in manuals and curriculum as reference, and it covered a lot of church history. And then also, there's the Church History in the Fullness of Time student manual. But besides that, there really hasn't been an updated history of the church to cover where the church has come since the early days and kind of revisit the restoration as well and retell the story. And that's where Saints is coming from. This is a new, up-to-date history of the church. And even though history sounds like a loaded term and it also sounds like a boring term to some, the church has made great efforts to make sure that this history is much more of a story than a textbook or a lecture in class. This is meant to be an engaging and an inspiring work of art. Yet it's not fiction. They made very sure that everything they write is backed up by the primary sources and something in the historical record, even when they're expressing feelings like, oh, and Joseph felt sad, or and Emma was discouraged. All of those little emotional anecdotal details are being backed up, yet you wouldn't even know because they tell the story so smoothly.
Yes, that's I think a really interesting aspect of it. It's a lot of people who don't write history themselves, which is probably most people, I imagine, maybe don't realize how much goes into the art, really, of writing history and the kind of decisions you make and the trade-offs that exist when you choose to write history one way versus writing it another way. And this is something professional historians discuss amongst each other all the time and debate and argue about what's really the best way to write history and whatnot. But the church had to kind of grapple with this kind of decision themselves when they decided they're going to do this big project. How do we write this history? And a lot of the factors that go into it, and any historian will agree, you've got to consider things like, who's your audience? Who are you trying to reach? And what kind of story are you trying to tell? And you know, you've got to make these kinds of decisions. And so it wasn't necessarily easy trying to figure out. The important thing for the church was they wanted it to be something people would read, but of course they wanted it to be absolutely, you know, factual. They wanted to be able to back it up and make sure it was defensible based on the very best available primary sources, which the church itself has been publishing and publicizing through the Joseph Smith Papers Project. And so maybe, Stephen, could you have the whole volume and you've read the whole thing, and so maybe you could shed a little light on how the church had this written, why they had it written, and what are they doing to maybe try and compensate for some of the trade-offs that come from telling it as more of a narrative rather than getting into the nitty-gritty details of the history.
Yeah, sure thing. So you touched on, Neil, the fact that there's different kinds of history. So, for instance, you mentioned like documentary history. Mm-hmm. That's the stuff that the Joseph Smith Papers does. And that is, for the layman, for the, you know, the lay reader, that is the most boring thing you can possibly imagine. because all it is painstakingly accurate and nitpicky reproductions of historical documents without any kind of analytical or editorial explanation for them, rather than just like to explain what the document is, right? They're not going to attempt to explain or create the documents for you. They're just going to present them to you. So that's documentary history. That's the stuff you get in the Joseph Smith Papers in those massive thick volumes you see at Deseret Book that your eyes just gloss over when you look at them, right? That kind of stuff nerds like us just eat up, mm-hmm. but your average reader is going to be totally turned off. So they can't really do it that way. So another way to do it would be sort of like an analytical history, which is something like Richard Bushman's Rough Stone Rolling or Fawn Brody's No Man Knows My History, where you have your primary sources, but you're attempting to analyze them using scholarly tools to create an academic argument or an academic reconstruction of your historical subject, right? Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. typically these kinds of issues get published with university presses or in professional historical presses, these sorts of things. And you get the input from the author there, but it's more grounded in rigorous scholarship. And
right.
and you're constantly cross-referencing other accounts and other sources and other critical theories and analytical theories and so methodologies, etc.
And in that kind of history, you will get somewhat of a narrative going.
Right. That right? will emerge that, out of it. Yeah.
They'll tell you the story of this person's life, but you'll have all kinds of junctures and breaks where the author kind of breaks in and says, we're really uncertain about
what this,
happened here, or it's unclear what happened at this point.
Or historians have debated what this might have meant,
right.
or whatever.
And,
right.
And then you get you'll get off track a little bit with a discussion of various bits and pieces of evidence and why some historians think one thing happened and why other historians think something happened. And eventually this historian will get around to telling you why they think it happened, you know, what they think happened and why, and,
yeah.
and then all of a sudden you find yourself back in the narrative. So it's kind of a hybrid, but it still doesn't...
It's still not quite what we have here with
yeah.
Saints. That's a little bit more accessible to average readers, but it can still be rather troublesome for a lot of people, just
mm-hmm.
because they don't have an interest in getting bogged down in the minutiae and the arguments. So what Saints is doing is more of a thoroughgoing narrative history,
mm-hmm.
which is... You are attempting to tell a very specific story or a narrative about the historical figure from a very specific point of view or vantage.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're not going to be so much concerned with, you know, cross-referencing different theories or how different scholars have disputed certain things. What you're going to basically do is decide these historical sources, these primary sources, are the most reliable sources for us to reconstruct the life of this figure. And we're going to tell the life of this figure based on this select group of documents. And we're not going to bother with sort of, if you will, overly justifying why we pick these documents as opposed to others. We're just going to present a straightforward story based off of them.
Right.
So for the lay listener, you might compare a documentary history, if we're talking about like making a history of America. A documentary history would contain things like just a collection of like the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, Benjamin Franklin's letters, things like that. That middle ground you were talking about might look more like a U.S. history textbook. And then this narrative history might look something like the musical Hamilton.
Or, well, we actually have a perfect model with David McCullough's 1776. I don't know if some of our listeners may be familiar with that book. It came out maybe 10-ish years ago, a little longer. But that's actually David McCullough's 1776 is one of the models, the examples that the Church History Department looked to in trying to write this. And it was, he's a professional historian, but it's a narrative history that they were trying to write.
Yeah. So, that's exactly a good comparison. And we also have another comparison.
But your Hamilton reference is also much appreciated, Jasmine.
Yeah. And it's not inaccurate, right? Like, that musical in this case, it's taking life of Alexander Hamilton and it wants to tell you an engaging, exciting, meaningful story about his life, right?
And while people have bickered over the accuracy of the musical, for sure, as in all artistic tellings of history, there's no one that can doubt that it's kind of created a revival in the interest of American history, and it's gotten people to really want to learn about Alexander Hamilton, and I think that's exactly what the church wants to do with saints.
Right. So that's the usefulness of a narrative history, like what we have with saints or 1776.
Right.
It's targeted specifically to tell a specific story to get people interested in the subject and whoever they're talking about.
Right.
Which would hopefully inspire further analysis, inspire further research. And that's where you can tie in, or I guess it's good to tie in, a very important thing that saints has done.
Mm-hmm.
So Neil mentioned that, both Neil and Jasmine have mentioned that this book has been meticulously documented. Stephen Harper has said where, yeah, we wanted to say, and then Joseph told Emma with a smile, you know, to give a little artistic flair, a little layer flair, but you look at the source and it doesn't say anything about him smiling. So they had to take that out, right? Like they're trying their very best to preserve this.
Right.
So think of this as like the I don't want to say the factual, because that may sound a little prejudiced, but the factual version of Work in the Glory. So where Work in the Glory is a work of fiction or historical fiction, and so it takes lots of liberties with the characters, with the events, and so forth, this is sort of the opposite of that, right? But it still is a narrative-driven story. So in order to assuage the concerns of people who feel like, well, they might be leaving stuff out, or they might be lying about what the sources say, or
they're misrepresenting how
they're
strong
putting spin
the
on it. Yeah, they're misrepresenting
whatever.
It. In order to counteract that, the editors of Saints have done something absolutely brilliant. What they've done is on the online version, so on the church's website and on your gospel library app, what you can do is as you're reading along, you'll see these footnotes. And you can click on the footnote, and it will have, wherever possible, hyperlinks to the original sources. So you'll click on the footnote. So, for example, here's one footnote. Joseph Smith, History, 1838-56, Volume A1, page 3. Okay, well, that's great. Well, what does that say? Well, that is hyperlinked to the original source itself, either to an image or a transcription or something like that, so that you can see exactly where they are getting this information from. And almost literally in real time, you can see if they're telling you the whole story or not. You can see if they're accurate in representing their sources. You can discern the accuracy of what they're claiming. That is absolutely phenomenal. Like I said, to be able to do it in practically real time.
Right.
you know, this is as transparent as you can feasibly ask somebody to be, short of sort of prying their eyes open with little pincers like on A Clockwork Orange and like forcing them to, you know, to
read
this stuff.
And I think it's important. And also, in addition to having direct links to those primary sources, it's important to note that, of course, as we were talking about, there's trade-offs depending on what type of history you want to write. If you want to do a documentary history, that's great. You're going to be very true to the sources because that's all you're doing is publishing the sources. Nobody's going to read what you're doing, though, right?
Yeah.
You can do an analytical history like Stephen talked about, and some people will read it, mostly historians. Other historians will read it, and they'll all disagree with you because they're just other historians and they have their own opinion. But, you know, what the church is trying to do, though, is they want people to read this. And so that was an important factor in their decision making. They want you, as a regular person, to read this and enjoy this and find it interesting and want to read it again and again and again and to want to learn more, just like Stephen has been talking about, just like Jasmine has been talking about. So
it sounds like it almost becomes a way of funneling people into the history. They can come for the exciting stuff and then be taken straight into the details and the sources if that is their desire.
This is the gateway drug into the Joseph Smith papers. Yeah. In other words, but, if I can use that analogy.
Absolutely.
So is the new slogan of this era going to be every member a church historian then, or what?
Maybe.
We can hope, right? You know, Moses said, would to God that all of God's people were prophets, right? And I guess we can say the same thing about historians, right?
Well, and I think that is part of the message, right? Is the church is trying to remind us that our history is important and we need to be invested and we need to do what we can to make sure we are coming to understand it. Now we will pick up on this discussion when we get back. This is the Interpreter Show, and we are talking about the church's new history. We are back on the Interpreter Show. I am your host, Neil Rapley. I've got in studio with me Stephen Smoot and Jasmine Rapley. And on joining us by phone is Hale Swift. And we have been talking about the church's new history. It'll be released Tuesday, called Saints, the Story of the Church of Jesus Christ in the Latter Days. It's going to be a four-volume history of the church starting in 1815, telling the story all the way up until modern times, and a lot to be really excited about. We were just talking about how, excuse me, the trade-offs that are made when you choose to write history in a particular way, how the church has chosen to tell this as a narrative, and as a result, you get a particular story told. And on some level, you don't get an analytical engagement with the sources. You don't get a lot of that discussion. But the church has done a few different things to try and make up for those kinds of trade-offs. And this was an important decision the church made, as we were talking about earlier. When you write history, you got to write for a particular audience, and the audience the church is writing for is everyone, right? They want people to want to read this and find it interesting and engaging and bring it, you know, have it bring them into the history of the church. But they don't want to hide any of the history either, right? In fact, a big reason for this publication in the first place is to increase transparency about church history. So in order to provide better access not only to a narrative about the history of the church, but the sources themselves, Stephen was just talking about, as often as possible, the church is providing direct hyperlinks to the primary sources themselves, most of which have been published by the church already themselves in the Joseph Smith Papers. Another thing the church is doing, though, in addition to that, is they are providing a whole collection of topic essays. So whenever there's something where there might be more to discuss about the sources or the evidence, some analytical types of issues with the narrative, you won't get that directly in the narrative, but you will have a footnote that will say topics and then the title of an essay that's available on history.lds.org. And again, if you're reading in the digital edition, just like with the primary sources, these are things that will be linked straight to in the history. And so when you come to, for instance, Joseph Smith's First Vision, and I personally, I really like what they've done with the First Vision in this volume. They have a whole chapter telling the story of Joseph struggling to decide what to do about which church is true and how to...
And his family's struggle with
and
that,
his
too.
Family's struggle. And it tells this whole story and eventually gets to the point where he decides he's got to go pray. It has him go out in the woods. And eventually have his vision and everything and talks about what he sees. And it draws details. You know, everyone's familiar with the version of this story that's in the Pearl of Great Price, the canonized version, right? But, you know, there's also several other historical accounts. There's four total from Joseph Smith himself. There are another five contemporary accounts from his lifetime told by... secondhand by people close to Joseph Smith, Orson Hyde, Orson Pratt, Alexander Neibauer. And these are people who knew Joseph, who heard the story straight from Joseph, wrote it in their journals, or published versions of it for people in England and Germany and things like that. And the way the church has told the story in Saints is they have drawn from all of these accounts to enrich the telling with details from every single one of these histories. And you can get links directly to every single one of those primary sources in the footnotes. But in addition to that, there's links to a topics essay that will tell you more about each of these different accounts. It'll give you historical context for them. It will kind of explain why, you know, the details that are available in each one and why they were told the way they were in different contexts. And kind of give you that analytical history that you would normally get from a more academic type of history.
Yeah, so the First Vision example is rather perfect to demonstrate or illustrate the difference between a narrative history and an analytical history. So as Neil just described, what they've done in the narrative is created a harmony of the accounts.
Mm-hmm.
This is very, very common. In fact, it's unavoidable if you want to create a narrative about somebody's life. And Christians all over the world do this all the time unconsciously with the life of Jesus, because we have four gospel accounts of the life of Jesus. And the default way that most Christians read them is to just harmonize the different gospels into a linear story about Jesus' life. Now, of course, there's differences in the gospel accounts. Some of the events are recorded differently. There are differing details about when and where he was at certain places. So the historians come along and analyze what those differences are. But for the sake of a devotional narrative, you don't want to get bogged down in that, so you harmonize the accounts. The First Vision has done this. There's other topics that have done this. Book of Mormon translation, for example. Plenty of accounts from Joseph Smith and contemporaries about the Book of Mormon translation. There's a chapter or two about the translation. It's just a linear history that harmonizes these accounts. But then there's a church history topics essay on Book of Mormon translation. There's one on seer stones. There's one on witnesses of the Book of Mormon, et cetera, et cetera. The lost manuscript and all these sorts of things. So you kind of get the best of both worlds.
Right.
Depending on what your interests are, your level of interest and engagement. And, I guess, again, short of just sort of like forcing church members to do this, this is as good as you're going to get in terms of full, transparent,
right,
broad coverage of these issues.
Right, and I think that's a really important point to hit on, because people, you know, there are people online and whatnot who are already criticizing the church, and their first reaction, of course, is, well, these details are buried because they're in a topics essay or they're in the primary source that you have to click one link to yeah, read. And most people won't do that. That's kind of the big complaint. And you know, my own reaction to that is, well, if we had done a kind of a more analytical history that included more of this in the body of the text, guess what? less people would read it. And again, I just would like to go back. Professional historians understand this. There are trade-offs to how you choose to write a history. And the trade-off here is yeah, and Stephen was talking about harmonizing, and that's true. And we got to understand, even professional historians do this. But what they try to do is they try to explain the decisions they made in their process of reconstructing the history. If you're reconstructing history from only one source, you're doing it wrong. You've got to do it from a plethora of sources. And so this kind of putting all the pieces together is what historians do, but they usually try to explain why they're making the choices they are. Instead of getting bogged down with that, the church has not done that, but then they've explained more about the sources and the information in resources that they've provided, and then directly hyperlinked to the right within the history. And so again, it really is a best of both worlds. People can complain because, yes, not everyone's going to click on those links. But like Steve said, we can't force people to read stuff, but the church can make it available and make it as easily available and accessible as possible. And I think they've clearly done that.
Unless we think that the idea of creating a story of a history is new, in 1861, President Brigham Young kind of gave this commission to the historians. He says, write in a narrative style and write only about one-tenth part as much. And I think the best example of telling a narrative history, telling a story, is the Book of Mormon itself. We know that the Book of Mormon consisted of both large and small plates. And Elder Snow in the February Ensign talked about this. He says, the Book of Mormon record keepers kept both large and small plates. In the large plates, they recorded political and military history. They used the small plates for the things of God that were most precious. And he goes on to explain how this is exactly what we are trying to do with Saints. Saints aims to be a small plates history, one that focuses on our sacred past. It thus includes only a small sample of all the stories that could be told to show how the Lord works in the lives of the Latter-day Saints. And I think that's a perfect example of why we're trying to do what we're trying to do. The church wants to tell a story. The most important part of the story, not get bogged down in who said what, but what happened. Joseph Smith did see God the Father in Jesus Christ, and that is the foundation of the Restoration.
Mm-hmm. Hales, did you have something?
I was going to say maybe we could take one particular incident in the early part of Saints and use it to illustrate how kind of the tack that they're taking in terms of storytelling, and that's the first vision, because they're like reading it. There are a number of the themes that will be very familiar to those who have read perhaps repeatedly the Pearl of Great Price account, but there will also be perhaps some differences in framing that might be worth talking about.
Are there any particular differences that you had in mind?
Well, probably the first one is that it seemed like it was much more focused on his initial quest to gain forgiveness of his sins, which you see reflected a lot in the earlier First Vision accounts.
Mm-hmm.
And this kind of the subsidiary effort to figure out which church to join in order to support his effort to gain forgiveness of his sins, seems to play less of a prominent role in his early accounts, but more of a prominent role later on after he's had a chance to think about its larger significance for everybody.
Yeah.
That's a little bit rambly on my part, but...
No, I think it's a valid point. I think the earlier accounts, as you mentioned, have Joseph Smith asking for forgiveness of sins. And I'm not exactly sure the context of necessarily each account. Maybe Neil or Stephen are more better versed on that sort of thing. But in the times that he's telling those things, he's talking to a specific audience for a specific purpose. And it's not until later that he really starts to understand what his role in the Restoration is. I mean, it took him a long time to figure out that he was supposed to translate the plates and not get a professional to translate the plates. So it's only natural to assume that when Joseph has this first vision and sees God the Father, he didn't know he was going to be the prophet. He just knew he had a crazy, amazing, inspiring experience and had to figure that out in his mind.
Yeah. One thing that historians of early Mormonism have made very clear, starting with James Allen and others who have touched on this, and this is actually kind of laid out in Saints, the first vision for the first generation or two of Latter-day Saints was not necessarily like the defining beginning of the Restoration. We think of it today in that way, right? Mm-hmm. We put so much emphasis on the first vision being the event that opened the heavens and so forth. For the early Latter-day Saints, it was Moroni in the Book of Mormon.
Right.
That was looked to as the foundational prophetic revelatory experience of Joseph Smith. And it comes out that way in Saints. Joseph Smith talked a lot more about the coming forth of the Book of Mormon and Moroni than he did about the first vision.
Right.
And he seems to have understood his role relative to the coming forth of the Book of Mormon much more early on than he did his role with the first vision. So these are precisely the things that the analytically historians will discuss and will debate, but that you can't really get too bogged down to in the meat of the narrative. Otherwise, it's no longer a narrative, right?
Right. But as you mentioned,
the first vision is not it's not immediately obvious.
Yeah, that's right.
If you're Joseph and you've just like experienced this thing that, oh, I'm going to be the prophet. Like, there's lots of ways that the fullness of the gospel could be revealed to you. For instance, somebody else could be the prophet and they could reveal it to you.
Right.
But with the Book of Mormon, he figures out that he's going to have to do it a little bit earlier than it seems. He figures out how big of a thing the first vision is ultimately predicting.
Yeah, and I do think, like you said, the narrative itself in Saints, though, reflects some of this. It helps, it injects a lot more of that early perspective from the 1832 account with the personal forgiveness of sins and things like that. And while, as Stephen was talking about, these are the kinds of things that you discuss in an analytical history, those aren't in the narrative. But this narrative is reflecting the outcomes and conclusions that have been reached by historians in a lot of the analytical history.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's important for people to understand, that the good, solid historical scholarship that's been done over the last 60 years, let's say, is very much reflected in the conscious decisions that were made in constructing the narrative. All right, this has been the Interpreter Show, and we've been discussing the Church of Mormon History Saints. We will continue the discussion as soon as we get back.
Now, the Interpreter Show, with discussion, debate, and the latest information on all kinds of religious issues and topics.
All right, and we are back here on the Interpreter Show this evening. I am your host, Neil Rapley. I'm joined in studio by Stephen Smoot and the lovely Jasmine Rapley. And we are joined by phone by Hales Swift. And we have been talking today, so far, about a new church history known as Saints, the story of the Church of Jesus Christ in the Latter Days. Sorry, I had to think about that one a little bit. And we've been just discussing some background and context on it so far. I think we're ready to maybe jump into the contents of the 7 or 8 chapters that have already been published. But before we do that, we just want to remind all our listeners, if you are interested in learning more about this, or you have a question about church history in general, or about this new publication of church history in particular, please feel free to give us a call. The number is 801-254-1640. We'd love to have you on the air and discuss whatever your question may be. Again, we're talking about the new church history Saints. So why don't we go ahead and let's talk a little bit about the contents and what is it that we each have noticed about it that we like and that we find interesting about about what they've written so far.
Well, before I get into a specific example, I do want to comment on, we've been talking a lot about the narrative style, how it tells a story and it's very literary, it reads like a novel. And we've talked a lot of about a lot of reasons why that's such a good thing and why that's really neat that the church is doing that. Another reason or another great thing about that I want to touch on is its approachability for children. I've already heard several anecdotes from people who said, yeah, I've been starting to read it with my kids. It's been coming out in the Ensign and they've been enjoying it. And I think in a lot of ways that's one of the purposes of making this a story. It's whimsical. Even the little illustrations at the beginning of each chapter mm-hmm. gives it a very story-like feel, and it makes it interesting and engaging. At the end of the chapter, they kind of leave a little cliffhanger. You want to learn more. And they wanted to do a narrative history to make it interesting for the saints, to make it approachable for people all around the world in different languages, but also for children. And I think we underestimate the power that has. Some people, when they find out that the First Vision has multiple accounts, they get scandalized. What? That there's more than one way to tell this story? Or Joseph Smith told it in different ways? And it can be a little jarring, but the church in this Saints volume has shown that multiple accounts enriches our understanding of this First Vision account, and it can add to what we know about it. And I think the next generation of children in the church will grow up reading these stories and being just completely at ease with that idea. Yeah, of course there are multiple accounts. And isn't that a wonderful thing? Because mm-hmm. I know more about the First Vision because of those accounts.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, stressing again, though, while it's got a little bit of a whimsical storytelling feel, it is factual. It's all backed up by sources. And on some level, it's actually more factual than a lot of the analytical histories that we've talked about. Even your great historians like Richard Bushman, for instance, who's written what's largely regarded as the best biography on Joseph Smith to date, will make offhand remarks like, will editorialize a little bit, right? And say, Joseph must have been concerned about X, Y, or Z as he did something or other. And those are the kind of speculative assumptions that the historian's making. Or sometimes they'll say that, he stared off into the distance as he commented on something or other. And those kinds of details, those aren't in the sources most of the time.
I think the absolute greatest example of that ever was when Fawn Brody, in her very, in some ways, infamous book, No Man Knows My History, she was very critical of Joseph Smith, very mm-hmm. skeptical, sort of had a deeply cynical approach to him. But she's narrating Joseph Smith leaving Nauvoo and riding off to Carthage on his horse, right, with Hiram uh-huh. and others, and you know, she had an English degree. She was a great writer, very right. engaging, just like saints. But she says something like, I'm going to try to quote it almost exactly. She says, as Joseph rode off to Carthage to his destiny, he looked back and saw Emma one more time, and he knew that she thought him a coward. and so in other words, as Hindubi said, in other words, Brody knows that Joseph knew that Emma knew what Joseph thought, right? Like what kind of history is this, right? Like, so you're not going to get any of that kind of stuff right. in Saints. And, I think that's a good point to raise, Neil.
And it's interesting, though. Sorry, go ahead, Hales.
So no mind reading in Saints.
Right. No mind reading.
Right,
yeah.
No mind reading. And we laugh at particularly egregious examples like those from Brody, but this is something that even very good, like I said, Bushman engages in it from time to time. I don't have an example off the top of my head, but even very good historians engage in this a little bit. It's hard for them to not. It's often part of the analytical process they're doing. And the church was very strict on those writing saints. If you say something, if you say he smiled, if you say he stared off into the sunset, if you say he blinked, for Pete's sake, you better have a source for this, because this isn't going to be fiction. But, you know, so I just do want to stress that the storytelling aspect to it, the whimsical feel of it, the fact that it'll engage a younger audience, it can engage children. And Jasmine and I have read a couple of these out loud together, as we've been doing for Family Home Evening, and they are you really get the feel of the great storytelling that's going on as you read it aloud. But even as they're doing this, they are sticking to the sources, very meticulously, despite crafting a very compelling story.
And I might add that we've also been listening to Harry Potter together, and it's remarkable how similar the narrative style is. We've been listening to Harry Potter in audible book, and then for FHU, we've been listening to Saints, and you kind of get a similar feel about the way they're telling the story. They want to make it engaging and fun and exciting.
Mm-hmm. I like to call it the Mormon cinematic universe. Like there's the Marvel cinematic universe and the Star Wars, you know, like this is the Mormon version of that.
It sounds like they tell a very compelling story, mm-hmm. but every blush is footnoted.
Yes, that's a good way to put it.
And now getting into specific things we like about what's in these first eight chapters. Stephen, you were mentioning during our break that you really liked some of the stuff about the angel Moroni that they talked about.
Yeah, so the way we read the Joseph Smith's account in his 1838 history, the story kind of goes like this. Okay, so in 1823, this angel came to me, and his name was Moroni, and he showed me where these plates were, and then suddenly 4 years later, I had the plates.
Right.
And like he mm-hmm. just sort of like skips through 4 years of his life. Probably because he just wanted to get to the point of, you know, what his experience was. He talks a little bit about working for Josiah Stoll and marrying Emma and these sorts of things. But there were 4 years between the first time he meets Moroni to when Moroni gives him the plates finally and he can bring them home. And the first couple of chapters, it's like chapters 3 through 5 are about what happened in between 1823 and 1827.
Mm-hmm.
And I love the fact that during these years, we know Joseph Smith engaged in some things that have scandalized some people. He was involved in folk magic and treasure digging. He talks about how, in fact, he tried to find treasure for Josiah Stoll and these sorts of things, right? And this has caused some concern for people in the past, for members of the church, when they find out about this. What Saints has done is they have encapsulated all these things within the narrative where they're not like just sort of like addressing it one at a time. It narrates what happened in those 4 years, and it incorporates these sorts of elements. It incorporates Moroni's visits and what Moroni told him. And so that's the narrative side of it. The analytical side of it is pretty interesting because they have a church history topics essay, well, on seer stones, on Joseph Smith's, in 1826, Joseph Smith was brought to trial for being a disorderly person because Josiah Stoll's nephew thought that Joseph Smith was trying to defraud his uncle out of his money. He was involved with seer stones and all these sorts of things. And they have the church history topics on those, but specifically with Moroni, here's something that I find wonderful and fascinating. They have an essay on the identity of the angel Moroni. Now you might wonder, right, why on earth do we need an essay on that, right? Isn't every kid in primary knows? Oh yeah, it was angel Moroni, right? Well, it turns out that in Joseph Smith's 1838 history, what we have in the Pearl of Great Price now, in the earliest surviving manuscript for it. The name of the angel is not Moroni, but it's Nephi.
Mm-hmm.
And people have wondered, well, wait a second, you know, did Joseph Smith change his story over time? He couldn't get the name of the angel right. What's going on here? Well, they have an essay talking about this. They talk about the fact that initially when Joseph Smith told his history, he was reluctant to tell too much. I think we all remember what happened when he told that minister his first vision, how the minister, he says, acted with complete contempt, right? So Joseph was reluctant to tell people his visionary experiences, and so at first he wasn't all up front about his experience. Over time, he eventually tells the name, oh, and the name was Moroni. And we have two or three sources before the 1838 history, in 1835 and in 1838, when Joseph says the angel was Moroni, that was the name. Finally, we have the 1838 history where the name is Nephi, and as the essay explains, that was probably a scribal error, since Joseph Smith wasn't sort of handwriting this himself word for word. He was dictating his history to scribes. Scribes are utilizing pre-existing sources that were already in circulation, so it's probably a scribal error. Again, I love how this, and that gets that error, Nephi, was perpetuated in some publications in Joseph Smith's mm-hmm. lifetime. So, again, there's this ambiguity, like Neil said.
Right.
And historians would debate, was it Moroni, was it Nephi, etc.? And they get into that, and they discuss that. And they make a very, I think, persuasive and plausible argument that the angel really was Moroni.
Mm-hmm.
And so because of that, in the narrative, it's just Moroni. That's
right.
Just who you encounter.
Right.
You know, you don't have this little sidebar about, oh, Nephi or Moroni or whatever. You can get that if you want it, but the narrative itself just as Moroni. So like you said, Neil, they have justifications for why they chose to tell the story in the way they did.
Mm-hmm.
And this is just one example, the identity of the angel Moroni, who he was, what the sources say. And if you want to get into it, then you can eat your heart out.
Right.
One thing that I really liked in that chapter, and this is chapter 4, Be Watchful, when Joseph is working with Moroni to get the plates from the hill. At the end of the chapter, it has a pretty humorous little anecdote from Joseph Smith. And even though we talked about how this is very factual, you know, if you want to put he smiled, don't do it unless you have a source to back it up. Well, here's one case where we actually do have a really kind of fun instance of Joseph Smith pulling a practical joke. At the very end of the chapter, he finally gets the plates, and this has been a very stressful night for everyone. Lucy Mack and Joseph Smith Sr. and Emma are waiting in the home with bated breath late at night because Joseph wanted to go at midnight to get the plates so those treasure seekers wouldn't get the plates before him. And it was a very stressful night. And he comes back and he hid the plates in a log, so he didn't actually have the plates with him in the home when he returns.
Mm-hmm.
And so he kind of uses that to his advantage. And when he gets back to the home, it says that when he joined the others in the house, he made a sad face and ate his breakfast in silence. After he finished, he leaned his head forlornly on his hand. "I am disappointed," he said to Joseph Knight. "Well," the older man said, "I am sorry," thinking that Joseph had not gotten the plates, that he wasn't successful. And then Joseph says, "I am greatly disappointed," Joseph repeated, his expression changing to a smile. "It is 10 times better than I expected." You know, he's pulling a dad joke here on all these guys who have been staying up all night so worried about him and the plates. And it kind of gives you a sense of what Moroni and the Lord mean when he kind of chastises Joseph at one point for not being serious enough and for being too negligent. He needs to be more sober and focused, because here he is, even after getting the plates, pulling a little practical joke on his friends.
And what a fun bit of Joseph's personality that we aren't typically exposed to in the church, right? And in the way we've told his story in the past, we've kind of left those kinds of things out. But they've incorporated that part of the story back in, if you will. And we tend to forget that prophets are people too, right? And they have personalities. They play jokes. They can be humorous. And so I think that's something that's really important for us to keep in mind.
And that really comes back in, right, with the story of him obtaining the plates, because mm-hmm. it goes through all of his failures to obtain the plates, and all the times the angel chastises him, and all the things he gets chastised for. And those are really useful for their learning, right? Because it lets you know everything you had to go through in order to learn how to obey.
Right. We will pick up on this when we return. This is The Interpreter Show. We are back here on The Interpreter Show. I am your host, Neil Rapley. I'm joined here in studio by Stephen Smoot and Jasmine Rapley, and then we have joining us by phone, Hale Swift. And we've been discussing tonight the history of the church, and in particular, the new history of the church that the church is publishing on Tuesday, called Saints, the Story of the Church of Jesus Christ in the Latter Days. First 7 chapters are already available in the Gospel Library app online at LDS.org, and also in your last several months' Ensigns, if it's been published serially there. It's going to be a 4-volume history. It's a narrative history, and we've talked about some of the trade-offs there and how the church has tried to accommodate that. And one thing I actually just wanted to say real quick is, you know, I sit in an office all day where I've got bookshelves all around me, including many history books published by some of the most prestigious universities, Oxford, Yale, Cambridge. But to be honest, none of those came with hyperlinks to their primary sources or to secondary sources where I can learn more about the controversies or whatever the case may be. And so on some level, what the church is doing with this in having a narrative history, but then providing links to the primary sources and links back to further discussion on a lot of the topics that are more controversial or ambiguous. In a lot of ways, the church is doing a lot more to be upfront and transparent about the history than you'll even get from the most professional historians with the most professional historical presses. And so it's really an impressive thing the church has done. They've put a lot of work into this. If you are interested in talking about this with us at all, have any questions or comments about church history in general, about this new church history in particular, go ahead and give us a call, 801-254-1640. Again, that number is 801-254-1640. We'd be happy to hear from you. If you have a question, we'll try to answer it the best we can. In the meantime, though, we will continue to discuss some of the things we really like in these first few chapters that are available now. One thing we haven't talked a lot about so far has been the translation of the Book of Mormon. That's actually something they spend discussing on some level or another in a few different chapters as they tell the story of how Joseph Smith got the plates and how he had, you know, first he had Martin Harris helping him, and Martin Harris goes back east to, get the input from Charles Anthon, and that famous story that everyone's familiar with, and eventually how Martin Harris loses the manuscript and all of that. And then when he starts writing again, when he starts translating again, a lot of people don't know this, but Emma Smith was actually a scribe for him, Emma, his wife. Before Oliver Cowdery comes back, while he's kind of, he needs to get working on it, he feels some urgency, his wife starts helping him as much as she can, and it may not be a lot that was done with Emma, but she helped bring this record forth, and not a lot of people are familiar with that, and I think that's great. And they tell some stories from the time Emma was helping Joseph translate, and one story in particular that I've known for a while, but a lot of people probably aren't familiar with, and I've really enjoyed, is one time when she was a scribe. I'll actually just read it straight from Saints. I've got it here. Emma is his scribe right now, and it says, "One day while he translated, Joseph suddenly grew pale. 'Emma, did Jerusalem have a wall around it?' he asked. 'Yes,' she said, recalling the descriptions of it in the Bible. 'Oh,' Joseph said with relief, 'I was afraid I had been deceived.'" And that's kind of an interesting story, right? And that's a story we get from Emma. Emma told that to interviewers later in life who came and asked her about her husband, Joseph Smith, and about the coming forth of the Book of Mormon. And that's a story she told them about, is one time when she was translating, Joseph is going along and talks about the wall of Jerusalem, and is kind of panics a little bit, like, "Oh, wait a second. Did Jerusalem have walls around it?" And Emma was really impressed by this. It contributed to her own testimony that this was not Joseph Smith writing this. This went beyond his knowledge. He did not know history or the Bible well enough to realize that Jerusalem had walls around it. Just as an aside note, we do have now archaeological confirmation of Hezekiah's wall, which was built in around 700 BC and would have been the wall around Jerusalem in Lehi's time. So yes, we know archaeologically, not just from the Bible at this point, there was a wall around Jerusalem at this time. But Joseph Smith didn't even know that as he was translating. And that's just a kind of a fun story. If you're interested in learning more about that story, we actually have some information on it at Book of Mormon Central. BookofMormonCentral.org. We have a Know Why, Did Jerusalem Have Walls Around It, where we talk a little bit about that story and the sources that are behind that one there in Saints.
And as a woman, I always enjoy that story because it shows Emma, you know, showing that she has quite the grasp of the Bible herself, and she isn't afraid to show her husband, yeah. Of course Jerusalem had walls around it. Mm-hmm. Don't you read the Bible? But anyway, I imagine her thinking that. But
well, and,
as,
It does go, you know, we've developed a culture, you know, in the church where, you know, men are the scriptorians and women are the, you know, the housekeepers or whatever, right? But in the prophet Joseph Smith didn't even know the Bible as well as his wife did, right? And so it's okay for, and it's actually a good thing, you know, there's nothing wrong with a woman knowing the scriptures well and being able to
tell her
husband right. What's up, right?
And don't you forget it.
Shows me what's up on the scriptures all the time, okay?
But now that we're on the topic of Book of Mormon translation, one topic that is often talked about is the mode of translation. How did Joseph Smith actually translate? And how does saints deal with that issue? And I think, Stephen, what would you have to say about that?
Well, just like with Joseph Smith's practice of so-called folk magic, or the issue of what was happening in between the years when he first saw the plates and he gets the plates, I love chapter 6, which is titled The Gift and Power of God, which gives a recounting of the actual translation of the Book of Mormon. And the reason I love it is because of how almost seamlessly it incorporates or harmonizes these accounts, and it incorporates something that that Latter-day Saints sometimes are uncomfortable with, which is the fact that Joseph Smith used both the Urim and Thummim, which are the Nephite interpreters, but also his own individual seer stones, which he had used in part of his folk magic practices. And as with the other things, it just sort of seamlessly incorporates it. So, for example, here's the first description it gives, starting on page 61. Meanwhile, Joseph and Oliver started translating. They worked well together, weeks on end, frequently with Emma in the same room going about her daily work. Sometimes Joseph translated by looking through the interpreters and reading the English characters on the plates. Okay, that's great. We all heard that in primary, right? It goes on like this. Often he found a single seer stone to be more convenient. He would put the seer stone in his hat, place his face into the hat to block out the light, and peer at the stone. Light from the stone would shine in the darkness, revealing words that Joseph dictated as Oliver rapidly copied them down. Later it talks about what they were copying down, and it says, acting as Joseph's scribe thrilled Oliver. Day after day he listened as his friend dictated the complex history of two large civilizations, the Nephites and the Lamanites. He learned of righteous and wicked kings, of people who fell into captivity and were delivered from it. Of ancient prophets who used seer stones to translate records recovered in mm-hmm. fields filled with bones, right? It ties it in that way, which I think right. is really clever. It also says this. They returned to work, and Oliver began to wonder if he could translate as well. He believed that God could work through instruments like seer stones, and he had occasionally used a divining rod to find water and minerals. Yet he was unsure if his rod worked by the power of God. The process of revelation was still a mystery to him. Mm-hmm. So, like, you know, the image I get out of here is, you know, there's no freaking out, there's no red flags, there's no alarm bells going off, right? It very calmly and straightforwardly incorporates seer stones and divining rods and these things into the story. And it contextualizes it in a way that makes it intriguing for all of us. Joseph and Oliver had questions. How did this work? Does a seer stone work? How is the process of revelation? And that allows the reader to wonder that in their own lives, perhaps, right?
What I really like about that is it helps us put into perspective the fact that this is a learning experience, right, for Joseph and Oliver. And I think this was one of the most... The biggest thing being revealed through the process of translation for the Book of Mormon was like the first people to learn from it was Joseph and Oliver themselves, right? This is a learning experience. This is what's shaping them and preparing them for leading the church. And it's providing them with the doctrines. It's providing them with all kinds of things, and it's giving them the experiences they need. It's prompting questions, right? And we've learned about some of these questions all our lives. Questions about, well, how do we get baptized? What's the proper way? And that leads to them receiving the Aaronic priesthood and baptizing each other in the Susquehanna River, and eventually leads to receiving the Melchizedek priesthood as well. But this is such a learning experience for them, and receiving revelation is such a learning experience from them. And they didn't come into this with empty minds. They came into it with all kinds of cultural baggage, if you will, and assumptions about how the world works. And now they're having real divine communication with God, and they're learning how it really works, right? And what's really of God and whatnot. And they're curious. They want to figure this out.
And I love how the chapter ends here. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Hales.
I think one of the important things that this narrative does is it actually incorporates the seer stones, the divining rods, and so forth without alienating them too mm-hmm. severely.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's... You talk about how there are certain ways, spiritual ways and means that are culturally familiar. And I worry sometimes that we have a tendency to make seer stones magical in ways that they don't deserve to be, or make them alien and foreign in ways they don't deserve to be.
Right.
Because the person can have a vision today as easily as they could back then.
Sure.
Vision's a vision. A dream's a dream. The Holy Ghost is the Holy Ghost, and God hasn't changed as much as our culture has. And I think one of the benefits of reading history is that we can see people's spiritual gifts and appreciate them without making them something irrelevantly distant. And I think when we realize that the same varieties of gifts are available today, just as they were in any other era of the world, that's a really key and powerful insight, because it enables us to better lay claim to whatever gifts the Lord happens to give us. So there's that.
Yeah,
I think that's one of the benefits of this history.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I'll just read the conclusion, and I'll let Jasmine say something because she has a thing to say. But I love how this chapter ends, sort of summarizing all of it. The Lord instructed Oliver to be patient, talking about the Revelation,
mm-hmm.
Doctrine and Covenants, section 9, where mm-hmm. we get this discussion, why can't I translate? The Lord instructed Oliver to be patient. It is not expedient that you should translate now, he said. The work which you are called to do is to write for my servant Joseph. He promised Oliver other opportunities to translate later, but for now, he was the scribe and Joseph was the seer.
Mm-hmm.
And you might think, well, how do you come to that conclusion? Well, footnote, Doctrine and Covenants 9, and a letter from Oliver Cowdery to William Phillips, September 7, 1834. Right? Like there's a doctrinal point here that's being made. Joseph is the seer, Oliver's the scribe, which, by the way, I think is a nice little like Moses-Aaron dynamic here, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Like, and I think that's quite wonderful. In fact, the gift of Aaron is
what they later changed it into.
Reinterpreted
it in years later when the gift of the rod
becomes the gift of Aaron.
The gift of Aaron, which, in defense of Joseph Smith, is an association made within his culture.
Yes.
Aaron has the
as
rod,
a rod.
The divining rod was often associated as the gift of Aaron, right?
But I love there.
It also doesn't hurt that Cowdery is wonderfully learned and is an excellent speaker, and Joseph is relatively unlearned and rambles a little bit.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah, so I just love that point. You have the history, you have the story, but it's meticulously documented, and you have it all wrapped up in a nice little package.
Mm-hmm.
To go back to what Neil was saying about the revelatory process, something that Neil and I discovered as we had FHE a few weeks ago, we decided to kind of emulate the translation process, and we had a little activity that was really instructive. We literally took one of our smartphones and opened the Gospel Library app to the Book of Mormon, and one of us dictated the scriptures while the other one wrote.
And we put it in a hat, mind you.
Yes, we tried to emulate the experience as much as possible.
The smartphone
you turned
was
down the brightness on the screen
in the hat.
And while neither of us were receiving revelation or having to look at a seer stone or really like work it out in our minds, we were literally just reading our phones. Both of us ended up having so many insights from having to slow down and word by word think about the text. I mean, as I was being the scribe, we were reading in Mosiah 1, I kept asking questions because it was talking about, you know, the plates of brass and the language of the Egyptians and how Mosiah was passing these records down. And I kept asking, you know, well, what about this? What about their scribal practices? I've never even thought about this before, because I was writing word by word by word. So I can only imagine Joseph and Oliver sitting in that room having to work through oh, I've never thought about this. What about baptism for infants? How does baptism work? How does priesthood work? And hence, we get the revelation of the priesthood coming out of the translation of the Book of Mormon.
Right, and in a lot of respects, and I think this might even explain some things that people struggle with about the Book of Mormon translation sometimes. In a lot of respects, Joseph and Oliver were the audience for the translation of the Book of Mormon, and I think that does dictate how it was translated in some ways. But we will be right back. This is the Interpreter Show. Back here on the Interpreter Show, and it looks like we have a caller. Caller, you are on the air.
Oh, thank you. Yes, I really want. I'm really enjoying the show.
Thank you.
And thank all of you, brothers and sisters. Yes, I'm really impressed with all of your. Skill with the use of the language and your skill in covering the material and your scholarship, and I'm enjoying the presentation. I just like to add one thing, and that is I'm sure all of you are familiar with our beloved prophet, President Nelson's address last conference on Revelation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yes, that was quite good. And the last thing is, I don't know if the world realizes the amount of impressions that we in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, we enjoy a great number of impressions that guides us, you know, throughout our lives. And I'm sure in the world people get impressions also, but I never got impressions to the extent that I get them now as a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, that revelation is real, personal revelation. We don't believe in blind faith. You know, we believe faith based on knowledge and experience. So all of you, thank you so much. I'm enjoying the presentation immensely.
Yes, thank you. You're very welcome, and thank you for calling. And, you know, I actually wanted to remark... it is such a wonderful thing to have guiding revelation, and you're absolutely right. There's so many personal experiences and personal stories that could be told. And part of what the Church is trying to do with this history that they're publishing now, right now what they've published so far, it's all about Joseph Smith, because you're kind of getting the ball rolling, right?
But sure.
But as it goes on... the intent is they're going to tell more stories like yours or mine or just regular members who have had these experiences where revelation has guided them to the Church, has guided them in their lives, and the kinds of impressions and experiences they've had, and be able to show that this is really everyone's story, right? And it's about the story of the Church meaning the people, in the latter days, and how God has communicated with us and how he is working through us to accomplish his ends. And so I absolutely agree, and President Nelson, you're absolutely right. He has been, you know, he's particularly put a lot of emphasis on the role of revelation in his own life, especially since he's become president of the Church. And I'm very excited to see some of the stories that are going to be coming out in this history of just regular people like you and I who have had, who have been guided through impressions and other forms of revelation, and the kinds of stories they have to tell about those kinds of people. So thank you so much for calling and sharing that with us.
Yeah, thank you. Thank all of you.
Mm-hmm.
One of the really cool stories that shows up fairly early on in Saints is during the process of the translation. That's the story of Mary Whitmer. She's, I think, one of the quiet heroes of the Restoration, or heroines, if we want to get technical here. She's the mother of David Whitmer, and I'm going to read to you a little bit from Saints. Once Joseph, Emma, and Oliver moved to Fayette, this is in connection with the translation, David's mother had her hands full. Mary Whitmer and her husband Peter already had 8 children between the ages of 15 and 30, and the few who did not still live at home resided nearby. Tending to their needs filled Mary's day with work, and the 3 house guests added more labor. Mary had faith in Joseph's calling and did not complain, but she was getting tired. The heat in Fayette that summer was sweltering. As Mary washed clothes and prepared meals, Joseph dictated the translation in an upstairs room. It goes on and talks about how sometimes Joseph and Oliver, when they were relaxing, would skip stones on the surface of the water, but Mary had little time to relax herself.
Right.
But one day, while she was out by the barn, where the cows were milked, she saw a gray-haired man with a knapsack slung across his shoulder. His sudden appearance frightened her, but as he approached, he spoke to her in a kind voice that set her at ease. "My name is Moroni," he said. "You have become pretty tired with all the extra work you have to do." He swung the knapsack off his shoulder, and Mary watched as he started to untie it. "You have been very faithful and diligent in your labors," he continued. "It is proper, therefore, that you should receive a witness that your faith may be strengthened." Moroni opened his knapsack and removed the gold plates. He held them in front of her and turned their pages so she could see the writings on them. After he turned the last page, he urged her to be patient and faithful as she carried the extra burden a little longer. He promised she would be blessed for it. I think that story is wonderful for several reasons. One, this is before even the 3 witnesses got to see the plates. So the second person that I can think of who saw the gold plates, the first being Joseph, the second was Mary Whitmer. And beyond that, it shows that the Lord regards this type of work and sees fit to honor it and recognize it and reward it with blessings. So her work, just managing the home and caring for the people in it, was deemed honorable and important enough to warrant an angelic visit.
Right. Absolutely. I love this story, and it's empowering for women, but also it teaches us, like you said, about the way that the Lord regards our labors. It's the purpose of the 3 witnesses and the 8 witnesses was to be a witness to the world, to testify that the plates were real. However, at least in this account, it says that the reason Moroni gives for showing her the plates is for her to receive a witness, that her faith may be strengthened. It was as a reward for her labors and to strengthen her. It served a different purpose than the 3 and the 8 witnesses, not to evangelize, but to hold strong. And it teaches me a lesson that the Lord not only blesses us with things to help others, but also, just as you mentioned, to strengthen us. He regards our labors to help us and to keep us on the path.
Yeah, it is absolutely a story that every Latter-day Saint should know. And so I'm glad that it's being positioned in such a way that soon they will.
Yeah, and you would never get this kind of, you would say, didactic, personal, theological and moral application from just your run-of-the-mill analytical history or documentary history, right?
Absolutely.
Richard Bushman in Rough Stone Rolling never, to my recollection, never gets anywhere close to being this sort of didactic with the story, with the narrative.
Mm-hmm.
But that's because analytical histories aren't meant to do that. They're not meant to get didactic in this way. But narrative histories are very good at doing this.
Right.
Earlier during the break, we were talking about the fact that Jasmine mentioned the musical Hamilton, mm-hmm. which has a very clear political and cultural sort of point of view and moral that it's trying to communicate to its audience, right? you would never get that through a hardcore biography of Alexander Hamilton, right? And so, this narrative history of saints is absolutely perfect for both informing the saints, members of the church, about their history, but also making it personal, not just about them, but make it for them. Mm-hmm. Make it something that strengthens faith, that can draw them into it, that can teach them lessons that are valuable for their own lives, and that makes it, in my opinion, all the more engaging.
Absolutely. And one thing in particular about this story, it goes hand in hand with the one we talked about earlier from Emma about translating in the walls. This is a story a lot of people probably haven't heard before. In fact, I've got a confession to make, actually. I heard this 10 years ago in an institute class just after I got back from my mission from a teacher that was a little odd, and I didn't believe it. I was like, what? If that were true, I would have heard it from the church. It was kind of my thing, right? And here, ironically, I'm in an institute class, so I kind of am hearing it from the church. But I didn't believe it when I first heard it because I hadn't heard it before. And I'm pleased now to know, actually, no, this is a real thing. We've got primary sources from Mary Whitmer's children telling about how they heard this story from her. It's a beautiful story that, like the Walls of Jerusalem story, highlights how women have been involved in the Restoration and how they helped bring forth the Book of Mormon, how they helped found the church, and the wonderful and beautiful experiences they had in that process, and how, as Hales points out, Mary Whitmer is second only to Joseph Smith in seeing the plates in this dispensation. She's the first witness besides Joseph. And that's powerful. That's amazing, really. And just another plug for Book of Mormon Central here. We actually have a Know Why that tells a little bit more about this story. And we actually just recently had an artist, Bob Pack, create a portrayal of this beautiful story in church history. And so you can go to bookofmormoncentral.org and you can find a digital copy of his painting, which is just an absolutely beautiful representation of this this story.
I think one of the things that the story points out, or that this our experience with the story points out, is that with this new history, you'll be positively surprised by some of the awesome things that happened in the Restoration. So we're used to, in some sense, being occasionally surprised by some unpleasant story that someone managed to dig up from the bowels of history, but you will be surprised by how awesome our history is now.
Mm-hmm.
So there.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, since we're talking about the witnesses, with our last couple of minutes, maybe it's appropriate to talk about the official three witnesses of the Book of Mormon, which is how the last of these chapters that are out kind of goes out, and it goes out with a bang. It tells the account of the three witnesses and how they went to the woods to pray, and as they prayed, they couldn't receive a revelation. They had no appearance because eventually Martin Harris stepped forward and said, oh no, it's probably my fault, let me remove myself. Once Martin Harris removes himself, the angel Moroni appears and shows them not only the plates and flips the pages one by one, but also shows them the artifacts. The Urim and Thummim, or the Nephite interpreters, rather, and the Sword of Laban, and it mentions other Nephite artifacts that he showed them.
Mm-hmm.
And then Martin Harris also receives a separate witness. The beauty of these accounts is afterwards, they go to their families, and they exclaim. Martin says, mine eyes have beheld. Tis enough. Mine eyes have beheld. Joseph exclaims his absolute elation at having the three other people besides him see the plates, because now the burden has been lifted. He is not alone telling this story. And Martin Harris bursts into the home where the family members are and says, I bless God in the sincerity of my soul that he has condescended to make me, even me, a witness of the greatness of his work. And I think the lesson for us is that Martin felt he was just a man and had made mistakes, made some pretty serious mistakes. But all of us are just saints in this work, and all of us can have God condescend to make us witnesses of this great work.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, I just want to stress, that's part of the main message the church wants to send with this. And as the story goes on, as we get past these early chapters that are really kind of based around Joseph's life because he's getting things started, but already are bringing in stories like Mary Whitman, we're going to hear more and more stories from regular saints and the contribution they've been able to make. But that's it for tonight. This has been The Interpreter Show. I'm your host, Neil Rapley. In the studio with me, Stephen Smoot and Jasmine Rapley. And on the phone, Mayo Swift. We hope you've enjoyed our program.